Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
As we get closer and closer to the opening game of the New Orleans Saints season, the excitement is growing each and every day. I don't know about you, but it is for me. And tonight is the last preseason game. And then we get to probably a point in time in the season that most people don't like, as we got a lot of new players that we like, and they may not make the 53-man roster. And we'll talk about that with Christian Garrick, co-host of Sports Talk, in the last hour today as we head into the last preseason game here at the Dome against the Miami Dolphins. And then we have to get that cut down to 53 by Saturday, and so we'll talk about that. And we want to hear who are your favorites that you'd like to see that we hold on to. And, of course, remember, when you hold on to someone, someone else has got to go. In the second hour, we're going to talk to Kyle France, chairman for the Louisiana Stadium and Exposition District, otherwise known as the LSED. Your AAA Baby Cakes baseball team leaving the city, headed to Wichita. Who said what to whom? There seems to be some disagreement there. But we'll talk about the background of that and the possibility of the future of the Shrine on Airline as the LSED considers all of its options. This hour, a most recent decision by the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals here in New Orleans talks about the criminal court financing and whether or not it is appropriate, the court fines and fees, the imposition of same, and the collection process has been struck down by the U.S. Fifth Circuit, saying, in short, that the temptation is too great. And joining us on the line is John Devlin, professor of law at the LSU Law School. Professor, welcome to the show.
Good to be aboard.
So, Professor, it seems as though the facts of this case are very specific, unique. There's this judicial expense fund. They place a fine once an individual is determined to be guilty in the criminal environment, in criminal district court. And there's questions about whether or not if you don't pay that fine, can you put them in jail? The imposition of the fine, is it tainted? Tell us what the court is actually holding here.
Well, there are two decisions here that I think are probably worth discussing. First is the decision made in federal district court by Judge Vance in December of 2017 that focused really on two elements of the process. Again, as you said, the criminal courts of Orleans Parish routinely assess certain court costs and fines, some of which go to specified purposes, but some of which go to a general fund that is administered by the courts and used for various purposes to keep the courts functioning. Salaries of certain court personnel, not the judges themselves. The judges themselves are separate. But other court personnel, things as simple as having bottles of water for jurors and things like that. That general fund gets money from lots of different sources, but about a quarter of that money came from these fines that were assessed on individuals. The lawsuit that was brought on behalf of several individuals who had been jailed for failure to pay those fines. And the argument that was made in trial court, the argument that Judge Vance accepted, really rested on two principles. The first being that it was wrongful under the Due Process Clause to assess these fines and jail people for failure to pay them without considering ability to pay, without considering whether the person was, in effect, too poor to pay, so that they were being jailed, in effect, for their poverty rather than for any intransigence. The second issue is the issue you alluded to, the notion that the person assessing the fine, the judge, should be unbiased in the sense of having no interest in the outcome of that decision, no interest in whether a fine would be assessed or where it would go. And the concern was the dual role of the judge in both assessing the fine and also administering this general fund put the judges in a conflict of interest position. Fifth Circuit really only ruled on that second issue. They mentioned but did not make any specific findings as to the first issue about failure to determine indigency. But on the second issue, Fifth Circuit, based on some very old U.S. Supreme Court precedent, pretty much agreed with Judge Vance that it was wrongful for the judges to have both roles, to assess the fine and also to administer the funds that were achieved thereby.
So when we think about this moving forward, I often think about any number of courts, mayor's courts and traffic courts and courts that are similarly situated where a lot of the fines and fees that are generated actually help to go to defray the expenses of the court. Could this be extended to those courts as well?
Well, I think there are two issues here. One is, again, the specific concern here was that the judges themselves were administering the fund that was funded in part through the fines they imposed. So if there were some mechanism, for example, certain fees that are imposed, say, to make restitution to victims, are not subject to any control by the judge. So that would be an entirely different sort of issue. But any time you have the person who is assessing the fine also having the ability to determine what will be done with the money generated thereby, yeah, that's a due process issue. And that goes back to Toomey and Ward and cases almost 100 years old in the U.S. Supreme Court.
So it's really, in some of the language from the decision itself, it's the court says, while it was possible that the justice was not influenced by his participation in a state court case under the principles laid out in Toomey, Murchison, and Ward, actual influence is not necessary. It only mattered whether it would offer a possible temptation to the average judge to lead him to not hold the balance nice, clear, and true. So even this apparent conflict is in and of itself a problem. It doesn't have to be an actual conflict.
And that's right. And the Fifth Circuit was very careful to say that there was no evidence that any particular judge in the Orleans Parish criminal courts had done anything different than they otherwise would have done. But there is a basic principle of due process law that justice must not only be fair, it must be perceived to be fair. It must give the appearance as well as the reality of being unbiased. And here I think there was a concern about, as you say, the appearance, the possibility.
As you said before, this is a lot of old constitutional cases that form the basis of these opinions, kind of stacking on one another. It's interesting that here we are in 2019 and we still have a lot of courts, having been in and out of a lot of courts as a lawyer and just being aware of the practices as I was a collector of fines and fees in my role as sheriff. It just seems to me a little odd that we're still grappling with this issue, and especially in Louisiana where we elect our judges. A lot of states appoint their judges. We elect because we kind of like this notion of them having a lot of discretion, and this seems to erode away quite a bit of that discretion in some respect.
Well, it's a different question, right? It's a question of funding. There is a tendency, I think, in Louisiana to avoid using tax money, tax revenue, to pay for services and an effort to find other revenue sources, whether it be licensing fees or something like that. And this effort to supplement the funding of certain aspects of criminal court function by assessing fines rather than asking taxpayers to pay for it, I think, is something that's often a temptation for legislators. The unfortunate problem is, as the Collections Department of Orleans Parish Criminal Court found, is that these fines are often very difficult to collect because they tend to fall on the poorest members of the community, people who really have no ability to pay, and jailing them in an effort to get the stone to give up some water creates some real problems.
So but does this move? Does this move as far as that? If we continue down this path, that there would have to be an assessment process of all potential violators before the imposition of a fine to determine their ability to pay?
See, that's what's interesting, because the district court opinion really did rely very heavily on that issue and on that aspect. The Fifth Circuit mentioned it in passing, but the basis of the Fifth Circuit's ruling was on that second issue, the appearance of conflict of interest when the same judge assesses the fine and manages the revenue generated. So that issue of the necessity of an ability to pay hearing before there can be an assessment of a fine or before someone can be jailed, Fifth Circuit really did not address that issue directly. Now, there are other cases. Supreme Court has ruled in other circumstances that, you know, again, you cannot be paid. You cannot be, in effect, jailed because you're poor. But how specifically that would apply in this situation, the Fifth Circuit simply did not go there.
And if you were to use the driver's license analogy, that's a little bit more tenuous because I'm not aware that there's a constitutional right. It's more of a privilege to have a driver's license, correct?
I think that's right. I think that would be a distinguishable case. And also, again, the judge that assesses that fine or whatever does not benefit in any way from the revenue generated.
Yeah, if in fact that is the case. But a lot of these courts are actually financed by the fines and fees that are imposed.
Well, if that's the case, then again, that may not raise an indigency problem, but that may well raise the appearance of conflict of interest problem. It could.
One final question. A lot of systems are set up to have like one degree of separation. So the collection of the fines and fees, the imposition by the judge, the collection goes to the city general fund, but in many respects, it's kind of a handshake and a wink that all of that money works its way back to finance the operations of the court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see us going to that, you know, where we then assess whether or not there is enough of a separation, if there's this kind of, whether it be formal or informal agreement that this money is coming back for the financing of the court?
Well, constitutional law does and should work on the basis of reality, not on the basis of appearances.
Right.
So if the judge assessing the fine does in fact have an interest, even if it's a disguised interest, that would be as much of a constitutional violation as any other. The difficulty for a plaintiff, though, is that if there are, as you say, layers of separation, it becomes much harder to prove that the judge has an interest, the person assessing the fine.
Unless it's as blatant as a 100% of the fines collected every year just so happen to come back into that court's purview.
But those would be cases that would not differ in principle, but they would differ, and this could matter. They would differ in terms of the difficulty of proving the case.
Absolutely. Well, we'll wait and see where this is going. I think the court announced the other day that they intend to appeal this matter, to the entire panel of the Fifth Circuit. This was a three-judge panel, is what's being reported. So we may be checking back with you after the next opinion that's given by the Fifth Circuit.
I look forward to it.
All righty. John Devlin, professor of law, LSU Law School, thank you so much for your time and your insight. We appreciate it. We'll be right back. We want to hear from you. 260-1870, text 870-870. Should the users of the system be responsible to finance the system? And basically, that is the threshold question here with the imposition of these fines. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. The court spent a lot of time talking about this judicial expense fund, and the court outlined what it is actually used for. It's spent on salaries of non-judges, the support personnel, and related employment benefits, CLE, continuing legal education, travel for the judges, legislative expenses, conferences and legal education, ceremonies, office supplies, cleaning supplies, law books, bottled water, jury expenses, telephone, postage, pest control, dues and subscriptions, paper supplies, advertising, building maintenance and repairs, cleaning services, capital outlay, equipment maintenance and repairs, lease payments, all of these different things. My best recollection is to this creation of the, and I think it used to be called the Criminal Court Operating Fund at one time, and I believe those are one and the same, and it's now referred to as a Judicial Expense Fund, was that many, many years ago, there was a high level of distrust between the court and the city administration, and whether or not in this battle of getting the appropriate funding in order to keep all of the maintenance items and everything else of the court intact, because of the number of people that go there, visit there, take care of business there, whether it be in the clerk's office or the judicial administrator's office, the jury pools, the judges, and so forth and so on, because they couldn't get what they were looking for out of the city administration to deal with a lot of these issues, not to mention their own personal CLE travel and legislative expenses and the folks that they have representing the court during legislative sessions, so forth and so on, for the necessity of having to go up there and testify before any number of committees as to how certain things go on within the court structure. And it was this battle that led to the creation of this, so that they had a lot more discretion and control over the revenue being provided and the expenses thereof. And so I don't think that it was surreptitious in many respects as to the creation of the fund, and it just made it a lot easier and a lot more nimble for them to make these decisions as a court, as opposed to having to go through the administrative morass of what was going on at that present time under whatever administration it was. And this may go back as far as the early 80s, late 70s, maybe even further back, that this issue has been around. And unfortunately, where the rubber meets the road here is that what the court is actually saying is that it's hard for the judge to have even an apparent lack of a conflict, because he or she imposes the fine and is the beneficiary of it, meaning it goes into a fund in which he or she has discretion on how it's going to be spent. So if they're short dollars, there's this air that maybe the judge will not be as independent, because there's a pecuniary interest for the court to make sure that there are enough fines generated so that they can keep the balance in this fund alive and healthy and moving forward. With the size of the dockets, the number of prosecutions, a lot of different things outside of the judge's control, it really does become very much a delicate balance. But it's this appearance of this conflict that really is what's prevailing here, and says that that's the constitutional infirmity. Is that when you consider all the things put together, the temptation is just too great. We'll be right back. Want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. Getting back to this situation, this is part of a wide variety of cases that are coming through the court as it relates to, I believe, accountability, and whether or not there's the court, the criminal justice system, is going to be in the best position to have a deterrence to recidivism. And deterrence is the fear of apprehension and detention. If you don't have the fear of apprehension, you don't have the fear of detention, you don't have the fear of consequences of your actions, then a large part of the basis upon which a lot has been created in the criminal justice system, as well as the civil system, of punishing you for your civil and or criminal wrongs, are out of the window. So how is it that we're going to modify behavior? Now, understand, you can't get blood out of a turnip. But then there has to be some other infringement as it relates to your freedom and or your liberty, if we're going to try to accomplish this as a criminal justice system. It can't be, in my view, that we're spending all of this money going through this process, risking law enforcement's lives, bringing people to justice, to get into the process of justice through the criminal justice system, and the outcome is all of the tools as it relates to sentencing are more and more diminished. And what we keep hearing from the progressive is that first there was over-incarceration. And I've said this many times, incarceration is an outcome. Why the incarceration? And I remind folks that 99% of the cases in pretty much every jurisdiction are reactionary arrest. It's not proactive arrest made by the police. You present the evidence that you have, probable cause for the arrest. The DA screens the case, determines whether or not it's a viable case for prosecution, has a likelihood of success. There's enough evidence there. In fact, my mantra as sheriff was, my arrests are only as good as a DA's prosecution. And you have a lot of prosecutors talking about the fact that they're not going to prosecute this case. They're not going to prosecute that case. They're not going to do these kind of prosecutions because there's a firm belief for some that we have over-criminalized activity. Many of whom have said, we're not going to do petty thefts. Really? And I said this the other day when talking to the representatives from Court Watch NOLA, Simone Levine. Thieves in the state of Louisiana got a cost of living increase. A felony went from $750 to $1,000, which is probably a greater percentage of an increase than most of you have had on your paycheck in the last 5 years. So we keep moving the bar further and further away in holding people accountable. The motivation? Inflation. If you stole the same item today as opposed to 5 years ago, you would fall over the line to be in the felony respect as opposed to the misdemeanor. Never once thinking about the fact of the impact on the victim. And if you happen to be a minimum wage employee victim, and they stole that item that's now worth $1,000 as opposed to $699 or $700 when you bought it, the sanction is to the benefit of the perpetrator. Now, I'd like to hear from you. Am I looking at this all wrong? And what is it that we're trying to accomplish by making it harder and harder and harder to hold people accountable? And should the users of the system be in a position to have to finance the system? I'm not saying 100%, but why not have some contributory portion provided for by criminal defendants that flow through the system? And when we talk about the ability to pay, I mean, the argument is much bigger than just the ability to pay in a lump sum. The argument is the quality of their life and what they're willing to sacrifice and what they're willing to spend less money on in order to maybe pay restitution to the victim and cover a portion of their prosecution. I don't happen to see anything wrong with that. And maybe the court just needs to get a little bit more creative about the way that they address it. But if you're walking out of court after being found guilty for a criminal act and there's no or little no to no sanction, what's left for us as a society, as a community, to try and alter the course of conduct of individuals that are wreaking havoc on our community and are just leeches on our community that degrade the safety of our community each and every day? Now, some of you may say, well, no, you're making too much of a thing over this. There's no one silver bullet that destroys our criminal justice system. The system will be significantly impaired by 1,000 cuts. And every time somebody walks into the room talking about disproportionate impact, over-incarceration, over-criminalization, all of these code words, all of this virtue signaling is all about trampling on victims' rights. And as victims, we need to come to that recognition and realization and understand they don't want someone to be held accountable for your impairment. Want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWO. On a Blue Runner Gumbo opinion poll, should defendants be responsible for financing the criminal justice system? 59% of the respondents say yes. Let's go to line one, talk to Raymond. What say you, Raymond?
Hey, New, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. New, Sunday, UPS brought some packages to my house. And at 1 o'clock, two kids were walking down the street. They seen the packages. One was lookout. The other one came on my front porch, and they stole them, and they took off running. And we called the police department, and we reported it. To my surprise, of the attention the police are giving me, for what happened, because they want to find these young kids. Because what are they going to do when they're going to be 15 if they're doing this now? And what was inside the packages was potato chips, a bottle of vitamins, and a pair of scissors that my wife had ordered from Amazon. And these kids risk maybe getting shot or getting hurt, because when the little kid ran with the packages, he didn't even look to see if a car was coming.
Yeah,
and my wife was home when this happened, some people might say, "Oh, this is a simple little thing," but to my wife and I, we felt violated, and sure. I want the police department to do their job. I want them to find out who they are, and I want them to go and arrest them, and maybe it might scare them straight.
Yeah, but and you want to prosecute. Plain
exactly.
And simple.
You worked
hard for that money that you purchased those items, no matter what the cost is. You know, those are your items. And they
exactly.
don't have a right to come on your property and steal these packages and take off. And, you know, we got some of these progressive DAs that are saying, well, that's a petty theft. We're not going to deal with that. Really? Okay.
But what happened? Then the kids get away with it, and they'll do it again, and they'll do it again. And they'll get progressively worse.
Yeah, and you know what'll happen? Everybody will be traveling to the UPS distribution center to pick their package up because, you know, if there's no sanction, nobody's going to want to get a delivery at their home any longer.
No, and we're not far from the Christmas season.
Sure.
And if they're doing it now, what's going to happen then when everybody's getting packages at their house?
And
I went to every neighbor, no, and I showed them the video. As plain as day, it's my neighbor's camera across the street that really caught it.
Absolutely.
And I showed every neighbor, and I made them aware. I went to 14 houses down the street.
And that's the value of neighborhood associations, if you have one. If you don't have one, you should get one, because that's the kind of information that you can share with everybody. And if they see these kids walking down the street and they know they have a package, they want to connect those dots, definitely that there's guilt, but necessarily. Because information is power, and you want to let them know, hey, these kids were caught before. Now my package is stolen. Maybe that's the first place you want to go stop and ask somebody about. Raymond, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to Ray down in Grand Isle. What say you, Ray?
Hey, Noel. How's it going?
Good. And you?
All right. Hey, love, when I was really young, I got some trouble. But the problem is I got arrested for 28 burglaries, and it was pretty much because I turned myself in. But listen to this. Two things empowered me. Number one, I was really good at it, and that made me bold. Number two, there was no consequences beyond, you know, being a minor. There was no consequences for me other than back in the 80s, there wasn't too many youths being, you know, prosecuted as adults. So basically what we've done in the society.
So you knew you'd get a slap on the wrist, no big deal, and you went back out and you did it again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was horrible because it was in the middle of the night. People were in their homes sleeping, and I just went in and took the purse or whatever. But that being said, society today has taken all the responsibility of correcting the parent, you know, the children, away from their parents. They want to hold the parents accountable, but yet when the parents goes to administer punishment, there's a big backlash for that.
Would have been different for you, Ray, if you think they would have been more aggressive and you would have spent time in jail?
I spent 2 years because they were 17 years old when I finally turned myself in, because I knew I was on a path of doing something much worse. So that, if as a 16-year-old, nothing. If I would have known that if every one of those burglaries, they would have gave me 2 or 3 years, that would have been a good portion of my life gone. But because I knew I'd probably go to juvie or something like that, maybe go to a mental ward or whatever they would want to send me, and then I'd be released on my 17th birthday, there was no consequence for me.
Yep.
And today, when the parents, you know, you're taking that ability for the parent to correct the kid like they used to be able to, and I'm not saying beating them, but the society today is doing the same thing in the justice system.
Absolutely.
They're taking the responsibility away from the prison.
Everything is getting shifted, Ray. No doubt about it. Look, I really appreciate you sharing that story with us. I mean, I know that your heart's in the right place because you're trying to send a message to others to say, this is not where you want to be. And thankfully, you realized that and you brought an end to it for yourself. And we appreciate same. Thank you so much for calling in. Got to get to a break. We'll be right back. Folks, just a reminder to turn down your TV and sync up with Zach and Deuce tonight. Get ready for the last Saints preseason game today against the Miami Dolphins at home in the Dome. Coverage starts at 3 o'clock. The Acadian Windows fans first take with former Saints offensive lineman Steve Court and, of course, Seth Dunlop. At 5, join the first quarterback to lead the Saints to the playoffs, Bobby Hebert, Christian Garrick for Bud Light countdown to kickoff. Game time is 7 with the voice of the Saints, Zach Strief, and Saints color analyst Deuce McAllister and Steve Geller on the sidelines. I don't know about you guys. I listened to them last week. I was rolling in the aisles. It was so much fun listening to those guys. They did a great job. And then after all of that, you can pick up Christian again with the Cajun Cannon on the Point After till 1 a.m. So you're going to be chock full of Saints. We're going to talk about baby cakes when we return. Stay with us.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.